Hello and welcome to Power the Parent, the podcast. I'm your host, Charlotte Speak. I'm a level 7 CMI accredited coach, a StrengthsScope master practitioner, mental health first aider and talent consultant. And I'm also the face behind Power the Parent. In this podcast, I'll be speaking to parents in the workplace. Some of them are in traditionally employed roles, others are running their own businesses, and we're having conversations about life in general, insights about being a parent and having a career, and exploring the strengths that parenting has awoken for people. We will talk about things like the value that they're bringing to the workplace, as well as my guests very generously sharing their personal stories and anecdotes about everything life can throw at us. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Power of the Parent, the podcast. Today's guest is a true champion of parents in the workplace, and I know firsthand that she works tirelessly to find new ways to engage and support both parents and line managers at her employer. More recently, they've shared a personal update about their journey to diagnosis of autism. In one heck of a LinkedIn post, Becky shared the feeling of taking the mask off and began to give insights into her experiences. By day, Becky Candy is a change manager, an incredible co-chair of the parent network for her employer. And by, well, the rest of the day, actually, she's a solo parent to not only her son, but the newest edition of some incredibly cute kittens. And I say that not being a major cat person, although I have just heard an anecdote about how they are creating havoc. So maybe my mind is being swayed. Becky and I caught up briefly a couple of weeks ago to begin exploring her story. And I cannot wait to share this chat with you and her today. So thank you so much for joining me, Becky.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. Thank you for asking me to join you.
Oh, I know. I saw your LinkedIn post. I think we were like on the first day of holiday and I was a bit jet lagged and reading, like just having a scroll. And I was like, oh, wow. Like it was just such an incredible, powerful post. It was just amazing. I can't find the right words really, but it was absolutely incredible that you shared your story. Have you had lots of reaction to the post?
So much more reaction than I'd anticipated. I think the reason I put the post out in the first place is I was just having one of those those moments, as we all do in life, and you think, do you know what, I just need to get this out somewhere, get this written somewhere, of where I was at. And being that week was an autism awareness week, and I thought, actually, let's just start to write it for myself for cathartic reasons and sort of churn out what was in my head out there. And some of it was around almost like re-exploring who I am and what feedback I've had in the past, and looking at myself through a new lens and new self-discovery, really. And so I posted it up, and you know, you go off and you make a cup of tea and you do all the parenting stuff. And then later on that evening, sort of came back to, oh my goodness, there was a lot of reactions to it, a lot of comments, a lot of positivity, and you know, actually really nice to be embraced of actually who I am, and you know, the things that I perceived as flaws, or have always perceived as flaws, weren't seen as many flaws of other people. And they, you know, it's funny how you build it up as bigger in your own head as what these things are, and that impact, I suppose, because it's quite focused for you. But for them, actually, they sort of brought this, you know, well, you're all these things as well. And actual fact, those things that you see as flaws, actually we value in you, which was probably the biggest revelation for me personally.
To see yourself reflected in other people when you have been talking yourself down or seeing things, like you say, the word flaws, it must be such like an awakening of, oh my goodness, that's like, there's a whole different view out there.
Yeah, there is. And I think, you know, I suppose where it comes as flaws, there's probably, you know, a part perfectionist streak in that, oh, you know, always trying to do your best and be the better version of yourself, etc. But I guess when you mostly seek feedback is, you know, when you're at work and you are, you know, it comes to performance review and, you know, I always ask the questions, you know, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What could I try better? And as most people do, you know, you see the strengths and you think, oh, yeah. What are the weaknesses? What do I need to improve on? And those things always seem to come out louder, don't they? And clearer. And it's interesting. You almost prompt that thought. So you've got this almost this hyper focus on these same themes that keep coming up. And for me, it's when I look back over years, there's been a few themes that have, no matter what I've done or what I felt I've tried to do to address them or look at them, they still keep coming up. For me now, it's nice to look at it in a different lens of, you know, where I'm going on this journey that I believe I've got a neurodiversity, looking at what those things are from this new lens, from a neurodiverse lens, actually, they're not things that I necessarily have control over. They are just my way of thinking and the way my brain works or reacts. And it's, for me, it's become a bit lighter in that I can look at them and thinking that if I embrace them in a different way, I won't be so negative about them. I won't feel quite so negative and beat myself up about these things.
I think one of the, when you were talking, something that I was hearing, I suppose, quite loudly was the whole kind of reframe and getting to know yourself again in this different light and understanding what your neurodiversity means to you. And I think I've got very little experience when it comes to neurodiversity, certainly firsthand. You can read so much, but that's just clearly never ever going to be the same. But one of the things that I hear and see a lot of parents actually when they're talking about it from their child's perspective is that feeling of not wanting to be labeled and the impact that it feeling like a label can have. And I think the way that you've talked about it there, it's not about that. It's not like a diagnosis that suddenly puts you in this pot or this camp of, right, you're this and that. Everybody's completely different and you bring a new way of thinking to the table and a new way of feeling and experiencing. And you could see that in some of the examples that you'd given about your kind of way of operating in the LinkedIn post. I encourage everybody listening to go and find Becky's post. She's Rebecca Candy on LinkedIn, because I think it will be incredibly insightful for lots of people and hopefully pique some curiosity, because that's certainly what it did for me. I was like, right, I want to go and learn some more about this. And I want to understand that route to adult diagnosis as well, because it's quite a, you know, it's quite a different experience, isn't it, being an adult and going through this?
I think so. And I think that's where it is this isn't anything that I've ever identified in my, like, in neurodiversity as identified through my childhood as being neurodiverse or something different from that. It's only been, as you say, I'm the humble age of 45. If I say it quickly, it doesn't sound quite so loud. But, you know, sort of midway through my 40s, you know, I've got a child who is sort of nearly 7 years old. And, you know, through that pandemic, through the last sort of couple of years, quite an extreme situation where you sort of see, you know, we were forced to be together through lockdown, school shut, and, you know, operating just, you know, us at home. And I got to observe my son's, I suppose, his behaviours, his way of learning, his reaction, his anxieties. You know, there's a whole bunch of bits and pieces that I saw from my son. And I started researching online as to, you know, what could this be? Is there anything I can do to help? And often the things that I was putting in these keywords was pulling up things like ADHD or autism. And so I started to explore that myself, going and reading more and more. And then there's new literature out there, I guess, now, which is different from when I was a child, that girls often identify or show up in a different way to what is traditionally researched and how boys must have felt with autism particularly. And it was through this sort of Google sort of going through and reading lots of different articles that I started thinking, oh gosh, that sounds a bit like me. This sounds like things that I do, or my preferences, or my sensory needs around loud noises and quiet space. And and that realization for me that where lockdown had forced organizations to work from home and my job worked from home, for me it was an absolute relief. And I realized actually how much pressure I had been in going to an office, being amongst people. And whilst I love people, I love a chat, but I find it exhausting for myself personally. So there were lots of these things that sort of happened to me, and I thought, oh, I better let's keep looking into it. And then I suppose publicly in the last couple of years, there's been a couple of celebrities who have shared their stories. So Melanie Sykes and Christine McGuinness about being females, late diagnosis and autism. And when they were sharing their stories, I thought, oh my goodness, that is so me. And no wonder I struggle with some of these things if I am autistic. So I thought, do you know what, the only way you can really do it is there is this labeling potentially, or a diagnosis, a formal diagnosis, but then you don't want to go down one road thinking you are one thing and you're not actually. So I have sort of, I am going through the formal route through the GP and through the mental sort of health team to get a formal diagnosis, but it's a really, really long waiting list with the NHS. But my referral has been accepted, so I am on the pathway, but it could take a number of years before I get a formal diagnosis. So now sort of faced with that information going, okay, this is a new lens, actually, how I can make myself feel better, because it wasn't identified when I was little, because I don't have learning difficulties as such that were obvious. It's not held me back in my education. You know, I was okay at school. I've got a degree. I've got a good job. I can operate really well. You know, I've got enough, you know, intelligence there. So there was nothing that showed up from a learning disability. And behaviorally, I'm fairly compliant, although a very stubborn, independent person, but fairly compliant. But I guess I've always learned from a young age to look and observe and fit in. And it's this masking piece of appearing and being how you feel you fit in with the groups that you're with in society. And that's probably what exhausts me, is because you're overcompensating and thinking about how should I be here? What word should I say here? What should I be doing with my body? You know, I'm feeling really awkward. You know, I've got these thoughts here and so on. There's this thing that goes on that, for me, through my life, although it wasn't a learning disability that showed up, I then had more of the mental health issues. So I had, through my late teens and, you know, my 20s, I was being treated for depression. Imposter syndrome has always been a thing there, although I didn't know it was a thing, but always feeling at odds with people, although never know it, you know, people wouldn't detect that, but I felt it inside that, oh, this just doesn't feel right, this doesn't feel comfortable. I've always been able to label it as something else, and now it's suddenly you think, okay, well, if this is autism or a neurodiversity, it might not just be autism, there could be a number of different neurodiversities that is my makeup. I can now start looking, going, actually, for all those years I used to find telephone calls difficult because I can't see someone's face. And I thought, maybe my hearing is wrong. And my hearing was absolutely fine. I'm thinking, well, why can I not concentrate easily when I can't see someone's face when talking, etc. This could be a neurodiversity thing. So it's interesting how it then sort of, you can look back with a new lens. And that is, it's so refreshing, really, to be fair. And it is that learning self-discovery. And for me, as whilst, although I'm waiting for a formal diagnosis, I am able now to work with my teams at work, with my people manager, with my colleagues, and start to really look at what does work for me and what doesn't work for me and what I actually need, rather than, you know, the things that always came up in my job is you've got to be comfortable with ambiguity. And I've never felt comfortable with ambiguity. I like certainty. I like planning. I get anxious when I don't know what I'm doing or how I contribute or, you know, what is expected of me. And in my job, there's a lot of ambiguity. But what I can do is, instead of it being brushed off or just get comfortable with it, which is just not possible for me to be, I can articulate now, right, these are the things I need to do until I know what I, you know, what's expected of me. You know, I can just park it to the side. You know, it can be completely ambiguous. I can't even say the word. That's how much I don't like it. Ambiguous. Obviously, I'm totally rejecting ambiguity now, aren't I?
I won't even name it.
No. I won't even accept it exists. But, you know, I'm giving myself, and permission is another big word for me, is I'm giving myself permission to just let that go and not worry about it until I need to worry about it, until there is some certainty that I can plan around. And so I'm very much working within my, you know, what is within my control and what's outside of my control, and letting go some of those other bits. But in the past, before I genuinely, I suppose, understood that this is something that is it's the way I'm built, I'd keep forcing myself to try and be comfortable with ambiguity, but I didn't ever understand what that meant. So it is nice as a later in life, you can unpick it differently. I mean, there is a bit of sadness that goes along thinking all these years of imposter syndrome and feeling less than myself has probably held me back in my own self-confidence and put my head above the parapet. But perhaps actually you know, maybe there's a serendipitous moment of discovering this later in life, when I have enough life experience to cope with what that might mean for me, to not send me in a tailspin, and to look at it with a maturity and also that confidence that comes with experience in life. So yeah, it's like a new chapter, but it just feels now suddenly I found people that I do feel comfortable with, and I think, oh yes, this is a community that I can understand, and the same difficulties, although every person who has neurodiversity have completely different, I suppose, spikiness of what they lean into and what they find are challenges. But the experience when you find a challenge, the anxiety, the uncertainty, the overwhelm, the exhaustion, these are all similar impacts of experiencing something that, you know, is really uncomfortable for you. But then I think anybody could probably relate to that, whether you've got neurodiversity or not.
Yes, but it sounds like it's like a different level of understanding for you now. You've, even without the longer term NHS plan, even with the short term, where you've already got to, it sounds like there's like this crystallization of what's important to you and what your actual needs are. And I mean, I guess, does that lead to clearer conversations in the workplace? Are you able to kind of say, like, this is why I'm feeling like this, or actually what I need in this moment is, you know, don't even bother talking to me about ambiguity, for example. is that one of the practical things that you can do with your new insights?
Yeah, that is, and that is definitely the journey I'm very much on at the moment. And luckily, the organisation I work with, you know, we've got in-house coaches. So, and my people manager is amazing. But so I'm working with one of our in-house coaches to sort of really look at and be truly honest about what I find comfortable and easy and what I genuinely find difficult. Because in the past, I'd almost be, well, I wouldn't be in denial with myself, but I would overcompensate, make other people feel comfortable, and not sort of say, actually, I need this in a different way. I would do all the legwork to bring myself to where they are. Whereas now I'm starting to shift and thinking, do you know what? Well, partly I don't have the energy to do that anymore, being the age that I am and a solo parent. There's just not enough energy left in me to sort of always go to where everybody else is. So I'm actually now starting to ask for, right, these are the things that I need. I'm uncomfortable with this, or it doesn't mean that I can't do it, but it will expend, it'll take longer, it'll take more energy, and you won't necessarily get the best out of me. But if you can come halfway here, these are the things that, you know, this is where you'll get the absolute best from me. So yeah, I've been doing some soul searching, and wrote a big old list of, you know, how to get the best out of Becky. And it does help that conversation. Now, there's some people I don't even have to have a conversation with, because we just gel and it gets on, and it's really easy. But some people where their preferences or their communication styles are the complete opposite to me. So I'm reflector, I'm more introverted, I like written things and stuff like that. If somebody is, you know, an extrovert, and I'm a bit of a planner as well, so I like to know what's coming. Someone who's maybe, you know, in the moment, is a talker, thinks aloud, you know, and uses all chaotic stuff or sort of more abstract language, I'm completely lost. And that has ended up sometimes for me conflict in relationships and in understanding and communication. And then it makes me feel defensive, and, you know, I sort of dig my heels in, or I don't really understand what they're asking for. Whereas now I think, well, actually it was their style. And it allows me to say, actually, yes, where I can feel us getting tense in this relationship, you know, these are the things. So it doesn't mean that someone has to always go to everything that I need, but it does allow me quickly now to identify. And if I'm up front with somebody else, where that conflict might happen, and where those tense moments can happen. So it's allowed me to better contract in with people to say, look, this is how you get the best out of me. If you can do all of those things, brilliant. If you can do half of those things, you know, fantastic as well. And, you know, and it just helps that conversation. And again, it's one of those things, whether you're neurodiverse or not, I think these are really important things to have. And contracting's always been part of it. I think for me, in the past, because I've always masked what I really have felt or needed to fit in with other people, I've never asked for what I really need. And I think that's the significant shift for me now, is actually giving myself permission to ask people to you know, to come to where I am a little bit more.
That's the dream in so many ways, isn't it? To be able to work with somebody who can articulate, like, this is me at my best, and this is where I'm going to add most value. It's a lot of the conversations that I have with people around strengths, to say, you know, to be able to bring your whole self to work, and, you know, the whole, and that is made up of so many different feeds, isn't it? And to be able to say, this is where I'm going to be most comfortable. And how do we, I think you use the phrase, you know, can you meet me here? If you, it's not an expectation that somebody's got to go the whole way to meet everything and tick every box that you're asking for. But if there's, you know, something in the middle, or, you know, a bit closer to you, or whatever it might be, then that's really where you start to have, you know, a more engaged workforce, isn't it? And somebody who is able to feel part of a team, and that they're, you know, the things that have seemingly been negative feedback, or we've told ourselves that are, you know, a flaw in us, actually they are special, and they are unique, and they are also the things that can make us really, really powerful and really impactful.
And I think, and it is, it's switching some of those things. Did you say the assumption that being comfortable with ambiguity is a good thing? For me, my strengths is that I can switch ambiguity very quickly into some sort of plan or an action, or because that's what I seek comfort from, and I can move through ambiguity quite quickly. Could it be that I don't really get it, I don't understand? To my mind, is you know, you just, you're always doing something. We live and breathe every day, don't we? We're always doing action. So I'm very action focused, and, you know, I see something, I do it. And that is a strength of mine, is to be able to go, okay, from this bubble of stuff, these are the things that we'll move it on and move it forward. So I think is bringing myself completely and really leaning into the strengths that I do have, and not being embarrassed about the difficulties that I might have around that maybe most people find, or lots of people might find, easy.
Yes.
And just, yeah, just owning it for myself. I mean, like, I don't have the pull to go back to work in an office environment. And I know it's not an environment that I work well in. Even when we were in an office environment and I was a hot desker.
Yeah.
I used to struggle. Then I used to work a couple of days from home anyway, to allow my balance with being a solo parent and doing the pick up and drop off and so on there. But
yeah,
even when I was hot desking, you know, when I look back at my behavior now, I didn't like just sitting at the desk, and lots of people had their headphones in. I found it a little bit odd. You know, I used to find myself just sitting somewhere else, away in my own little world, in my own little quiet world. And it's just so refreshing to be at home and working in that way all the time, where I can have no distractions. I choose when my energy works with interacting with people. If I've got lots and lots of face-to-face meetings, I say face-to-face, virtual face-to-face, I know I need to book time out in my diary to have just a downtime where I'm thinking and I'm working and I'm writing stuff down, because I know that's how I do that work. And it's kind of owning that to me, that I find that I don't have to be physically with somebody to make that connection. And it was interesting that I found that through the pandemic, lots of my colleagues found that disconnect really uncomfortable. And that's probably the stark thing I kept thinking. I'm thinking, well, that doesn't feel uncomfortable to me. That feels comfortable. And that's when you sit there thinking, gosh, am I going mad? Why am I not feeling what they're feeling? And instead of self-doubting, now you think, well, that's just the way that my brain is wired, and that's what I feel comfortable with. And it's accepting that and giving myself permission to not do what everyone else feels is comfortable, and to work in my best way. Mm-hmm. And still deliver what people need.
I feel just empowered listening to you. and just incredibly, I don't know, I guess, like, motivated, I think, to really own that narrative of who you are, and whatever you want to call it, labels, diagnosis, you know, whatever word resonates with you. But that, I think it's like knowledge is where I go to. And it's that knowledge of who you are and when you're at your best and how you can bring your whole self to the workplace, I think there's so much power in that. And really it should be simple, but I guess, you know, simple isn't always easy, is it? And I'd put it in the simple bucket purely because, like, who doesn't want a workforce that feels that engaged, that feels like they're able to be themselves and really embrace their way of working? Because that's where amazing things happen, isn't it? So I think it's just wonderful that you're able to share your story. And I know that it will resonate with a lot of people and hopefully just give people a nudge as well, if either from you as an individual, if you're sat there thinking, oh, I'm not sure if this might be me as well, but also for those friends around you, if you're spotting some of these things, I think it's, you know, nothing will replace a formal diagnosis, but even just having a conversation with people sometimes can be really helpful, can't it?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's even just getting to know yourself and really being honest with yourself. Because I think, you know, we all like to fit in, don't we? Lots of people like to fit in and to be part of a crowd and part of a group. And, you know, you start to modify bits of who you are to do that. And that's where that masking comes in. I think, you know, there were times, because one of my things is I'll often interrupt people because my brain, there seems to be sometimes little filter between what I'm thinking in my head to then what comes out of my mouth.
Yes.
And to fit in, because that's, you know, and I know it's really annoying if I interrupt somebody when they're mid-flow. So it's something that I try not to do. But in order to stop myself from doing that, in meetings, I'll often sit there with my hand physically over my mouth to stop myself from doing that. Yes. And to sit and wait. Yeah. The trouble that that has for me, so that is to, you know, fit in with other people. The trouble that I have is often I'm interrupting either because there's a train of thought that I know I'm going to absolutely lose. And it's not that I'm deliberately interrupting. It's like, oh my God, I need to get that out there while they're saying that, because it's, you know, and it's going to fleet and disappear off, especially my memory's really bad these days. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it could be, and quite a lot of the time it could be, that my brain has gone, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, especially mm-hmm. if they're being ambiguous. I'm thinking, you're now just talking at me. You're talking these words. I don't know what you're saying, but you're looking at me as if you're expecting me to understand it. And yeah. This dialogue is often then going on my head. I'm like, well, you've got to stop right now and let me ask some questions, because I need to clarify, you know, is this it? Is it that?
Yeah.
And so I think it is that fine balance, isn't it, of really knowing yourself as to why you're doing it. Are you just being impulsive because you've got a thought in your head? And in fact, I should just write that thought down rather than just jumping straight in there. So those are the techniques I'm trying to do to stop that. Mm. But on those moments where I don't understand what they're saying and where they're doing, they're still the right times to often interrupt in a polite way.
Yeah.
Because even if they carry on talking, they've lost me already. And they've got to backtrack. And I think, you know, let's not waste any more time here, because I've no idea what you're talking about right now. I know what you think is making sense, but it really isn't for me right now. And it's really knowing yourself as to what are your difficulties. And we all like to hide our difficulties, don't we? And it's just being kind, because I suppose we don't know. I would never have known I was on this journey. Mm. And no one else would have ever known I was on this journey. Mm. Because if I was struggling, I would hide away. I'd disappear off. I mean, even when I had depression all those years ago, and I was I was on medication for it, nobody at work, apart from maybe my line manager, who I just told, you know, so that they're aware, would have known I was depressed. Because I know how to show up in a bubbly, lively, friendly, smiley way, an interested way every day, because I know that's a learned behavior. I know that's what people like to be around. It's a learned response that I have. And so all the way through my depression, nobody would have had a clue. What they then don't see is, you know, that second you've walked out of the office or you're going home, you know, I might have been in tears, you know, I might have, as soon as I've got home, just then sleep for the rest of the evening because I was so exhausted of putting on this face. And so to me, that is the powerful thing, that this has gone undiagnosed for so many years and put down to, you know, my depression was put down to reaction to, you know, my dad passing away when I was 17, or, you know, any number of things it could have been put down to.
Mm.
That there was actually a different struggle going on. And that is the sort of thing that I think we need to be mindful of, what we aren't seeing from people. People will show up a certain way, but that might not always be what they're feeling. And that's so key in mental health. And I think if you can start to be a bit honest about yourself and show those things a bit differently, you can get that help sooner. And I think for me, it was actually unpicking for myself those vulnerabilities that I actually feel every day, although don't show it necessarily. You know, it shows up as one thing, I suppose. Yeah, that's it. It shows up as one thing of that interrupting, you're seen as not listening. But that wasn't the problem. That wasn't the cause. Mm. The discomfort with ambiguity isn't just because, you know, it's because that's my brain likes to plan. It likes certainty. I get really anxious in these circumstances. You know, liking to work from home is because of my sensory issues of noise and being interrupted. And when I'm in the zone, I like to be in a quiet zone working on something, because it takes me a while to almost transition from one piece of work to another piece of work. Mm. And I sort of get that hyper focus on things. So yeah, I think there's a brutal honesty, I think, for yourself. You've got to really understand yourself first, mm-hmm. before you can genuinely ask for what you need.
Yeah. Oh, honestly, Becky, you need your own show. I think, you know, when you've got the time and the headspace, could you also write a book, please? Just gonna put it out there. I'll definitely come to the launch. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for sharing your story so generously. It really is something to behold, to listen to what it's meant to you on a day-to-day basis, and the impact in the workplace, and all that has come with your discovery and will continue to. Maybe we need to do a part two in a couple of years time. And see what the new learnings have been, and wait, but if you're still on a waiting list.
I probably will be, yeah.
So thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and hopefully we will have another conversation in the future.
Lovely. Thank you, Charlotte.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Power of the Parent, the podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please rate, review and subscribe. And if you could tell all your friends about the podcast, that would be wonderful. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find me on Instagram. Just search Power of the Parent. See you next time.